This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
the award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. On the job site. Did you know that a big portion of people who listen to Joy at work, just like you? Right now, times are very tough financially, and without your support, Joy may not be around to help you through your work day. So tell your workmates, your next door neighbour, and even your mum to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
This is Saturday Magazine.
You are on Joy 94.9, Saturday Magazine. Macca and Tass, Paul on panel. Misha Ketchell, who is the editor of The Conversation.
And a regular on our show,
very Macca. Regular, has joined us. Welcome, Misha. How are you?
I'm very good.
Great to have you back in the studio, by the way.
Thank you.
Sometimes it feels like it's been too long to have you back in here, because I really enjoy the conversations that we have. They're always deep.
Oh, well, actually, I was listening on the way into Kimberley Kitching, and it sounded like you guys were having so much fun. I was thinking, I don't want to come on and be deep now.
Well, you can be funny if you want. Okay.
Well, Kimberley, you know, when we asked her about, will Elbow be there, and, you know, she talked about the rules and stuff.
Oh, we know about the rules, don't we,
Macca? Yeah, that's right. But I'm going to
the rules that were completely disregarded at the last time that they should have been enacted. Yeah. There was no election.
So we'll put $50 on. I'll put $50 on Elbow not being there for the next election on sports. But I'll probably get good odds at the moment. And I always donate that money to Joy that I win.
Excellent. You're very good.
So before we proceed into a couple of issues, what's been your highlight in the last year?
Apart from coming in here.
God, in the whole year.
Yeah. Yeah, in your capacity as a journalist, as a editor of a conversation. You can tell us your personal highlights as well, if you wish.
I'd say that my personal highlight has been seeing, in my view at least internationally, some progress on the understanding of the climate crisis. Greta Thunberg, that sort of movement on that issue. I feel that that's represents, you know, something quite positive. I still feel like in Australia we've got a long way to go.
Yeah, we do.
And the political debate is not sort of keeping pace with what the science is telling us and what we're seeing. And I was actually just in Sydney late last week, and I was walking through Sydney to an event I was going to, and Sydney's, as you know, was ringed by bushfires last week, and it was the most eerie, apocalyptic scene I think I've ever seen in a major city. I mean, the sun was red. You couldn't see where you were going.
I think Black Friday in Victoria was the most recent time I saw that.
Yeah.
When the sky was literally red.
Yeah.
And, you know, in terms of the debate, you know, Misha, that it's not moving in the way that I think, you know, the Australian population. You look at the interaction between those farmers and the National Party guys at the front of Parliament House this week. Extraordinary. You know, National Party voters.
That's right, and sort of basically saying to the National Party,
you know, you're rooted.
You need to do something on this.
And you're not listening to us.
Yeah.
What about a low lies?
Oh, God.
Going on Tom Elliott's show?
Well, yeah, that was an interesting experience, should we say. I mean, you know, to some extent, I mean, for me, the reaction to our policy on not publishing disinformation from people who are climate science deniers, I thought was very telling and interesting. And that it certainly wasn't a great moment for me in terms of, having Eric Abetz in Parliament, you know, accuse the conversation of being like Hitler and Mussolini, and, you know, that wasn't
I would have thought he'd steer away from those people with his heritage.
Yeah, anyway, so that probably wasn't great. I think the Medibank, I know you were talking about that earlier in the program, and you've taken
that was a real low life for me last week.
It really is. I was involved with some panel discussions on the refugee crisis in Europe in the past couple of weeks, with some academics talking about just the sheer number of refugees and how it's being dealt with there. And, you know, from any angle, Australia is in a position where the scale of the problem is not the same as it is in many countries overseas, say in Italy or Greece or whatever, for example. The strength of our draconian policies is breathtaking to everybody around the world. And, you know, it seems to me very disappointing that you would be so agitated about letting medical practitioners make decisions about people's medical treatment.
I woke up on Thursday morning feeling really flat about that. I thought, what has happened to our society that we have become so uncaring and unkind? What's happened? I don't understand that how we have arrived in this position that we don't care for, you know, our fellow citizens anymore.
Yeah, I think...
Well, hang on, they're not our fellow citizens.
Well, okay, yes.
No,
I technically understand that, but they're human beings,
exactly,
Maker.
Yeah.
Human beings who are in our care.
In our care,
and
yeah.
Why is it
and
that...
And custody.
Misha.
Yeah, I mean, look, I could only agree. I think it's, you know, deeply depressing. I mean, if you look at our entire regime, you know, we've got offshore processing, we've got boat turnbacks, we've got temporary protection visas... you know, this medevac law, I mean, every little aspect of it seems to me to be, you know, overall cruel and inhumane. And what's really significant is those people who are very well versed in this say that it's fundamentally unnecessary now, given where we're at. Now, there was a period of time in the, you know, Rudd-Gillard years when the policies were relaxed and there were a lot more boats arriving. I think there's something like 50,000 people that arrived in that period. There is definitely, arguably, a correlation between some of those changes and those boats arriving. But there were also many push factors that emerged at that period of time.
Misha, why do you think the government actually did this? What was behind it?
I think behind it is politics. You know, basically a bidding war to be seen to be the toughest on these policies when all sides of politics know that there is an unease within the electorate. And it's been a long process, really, since I think it was Keating initially that brought in some of the mandatory detention policies in the early 90s. So there's been like a long history of basically both sides of politics beating each other up on this issue. And that sort of seems to be how we've ended up where we are.
Hang on, we've got a taker here for my...
$50.
For the bet it says, depending on who you name to take Elbow's place... I'll take your bet with the $50 going to Joy. Who you name is important, though. Well, no, actually, Chris, I don't know who's going to take Elbow's place. I just know that he ain't going to lead Labor to the next election.
Well, he might, but he's not going to lead Labor to anywhere.
But
really,
is there a mechanism by which he could be deposed? Because I thought they needed 60% or something.
Yeah, well, you can also fall on your sword.
Yeah. And why are you so confident that he would not be the leader in 1 or 2 years' time?
Well, because I think he's totally uninspiring, unfortunately. I think, you know, they've had 6 months since the election. There's no new policies. Oh, we're not going to show the government our hand. Well, how about you show the people of the Australian electorate what you think? And, you know, I think Labor needs a big change. It needs a big change. It needs a new generation. It needs younger leaders that are more in touch with the community. And I like Elbow personally, but I just don't think he cuts it. And speaking to a lot of his colleagues, they don't either.
Let me give you a counter-argument, which is that many people within the Labor Party are arguing that this is not the time in the electoral cycle to be launching new policies. There is a period of sort of introspection that's required, healing, policy development, and in actual fact, at this point in the cycle, what happens is less important.
I can do it in 18 months.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if you're judging on the data of this period of time since the election, potentially there's a reason behind that. I think you'd need a longer period of time to decide.
No, I get it, but, you know, I just... I don't see that he has the ability to lead Labor to a win at the next election. And I think the party will decide that in 18 months or 2 years.
Okay, I think we should move on to another topic because, you know, we're going to get bogged down.
Yeah.
Angus Taylor. Angus Taylor is a Member of Parliament, Member of Government.
Yes.
He's the Minister for Energy.
Yes.
What happened during the week? Why has he caused so much attention and created so much attention in the media?
Well, really by being intransigent, to be honest. What happened this week was Naomi Wolf, the famous feminist author of The Beauty Myth, wrote She didn't write. She contacted Angus Taylor's office to make a complaint about some comments that were in, I think, his maiden speech to Parliament.
That's correct.
Where he had actually said that he was at Oxford in 1991 with Wolfe, and she was down the corridor and was part of a group that argued against there being a Christmas tree, and he sort of cast himself as a defender of Christmas. Actually, in fairness to Taylor, he didn't actually say she was part of a group, but he implied that she was part of that group by naming her as somebody who was living with him at Oxford at that period of time. She contacted Taylor to say basically she wasn't at Oxford then. It's a, you know, entirely misremembered, and she wants him to correct the record. Now, you'd think the intelligent thing to do would be to say...
I think I must have got it wrong.
I'm sorry, I must have got it wrong, you know. I mean, there's nothing at stake here. Like, it's not like it's a big ideological battle. Naomi Wolf isn't an ideological foe. It just doesn't give points to Labor or, you know, the other side of politics. It's just a human decency thing. But by refusing to stand down on this, he has shown that he's so implacably opposed to the idea of truth or facts or accuracy that it's actually become a big embarrassment, I think, for the government on the back of, obviously, the doctored document, you know, in relation to Clover Moore. So... It's sort of another little own goal for the government in what's been a really difficult time. I think one of the reasons that the Medivac legislation was so vigorously pursued, really disproportionate to its significance in terms of what it means for the government's operation of its, you know, border protection policies, is because there have been so many losses on so many other levels that they sort of wanted to have a win to go to Christmas with.
And also, I think, Misha, you know, it wasn't their legislation. Right, it was a decision by a parliament of which they didn't have control that it passed, and you know that to them that made it even worse. That you know, so for them to repeal it, yes, and the parliament has done it with Jackie Lambie's help, but because it wasn't their legislation, that made them even more determined.
Yeah,
even more determined to repeal it.
I think so, but I mean, again, I think you know any political sort of pundit would be saying that at the moment the government doesn't seem to be travelling that well in terms of sort of forward momentum. It's been very error-prone. There have been a lot of things that have gone wrong. Now, again, the key thing to remember here is that this period of time in an electoral cycle, it's a long way till the next election. Yeah. But at the moment, things aren't looking that great.
I was listening to my favourite podcast during the week, other than ours, of course, Macca, Patricia Cavallis and Fran on the Party Room. Just love my Thursday afternoons. Absolutely love listening into them. And they were arguing...
Surprised you have the time.
They were usually on the running machine, Macca, when I'm at the gym, believe it or not. What they were arguing...
Do you exercise?
Ha, ha, ha. May not look like I do, but I do. What they were arguing was that they have a very thin record of achievements, reflecting on the last year. Very thin record. Probably the only thing that they can hang their hat on is the tax break, and that's not given them the fillip that they're expecting to get.
I think that's right. And there's also mounting pressure on economic management, because the coalition's argument all the way along has been that they're better at managing the economy. We're in a very difficult time. There's sort of has to be a fairly, you know, austere approach because of this commitment to a surplus at a time when arguably the economy needs a stimulus. And I think people are starting to sort of see that and be a bit hungry for something to happen. Yeah.
If anyone out there has the ability to recreate the Oxford yearbook for 1991, you know, and change who was there...
Do you want it faxed in, do you, Macca?
No, actually, just send a copy to Angus Taylor. I'm sure he'd be able to use it. Saturday Magazine Joy 94.9, Macca and Tass and Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. Now, Misha, what did you... There's something else you wanted to talk about.
Well, I was interested in, I mean, what might seem in many ways a boring bureaucratic story that came out this week, which is an reorganisation of some government departments.
Oh, we've had lots of feedback on that.
Yes.
Yeah. And basically now we've got something called the Department of Infrastructure, Transport, Regional Development and Communication, which will take in the old department that also used to include arts. So the word arts is no longer in the title of a government department, and I think in the arts industry where there's been a long period of sort of being starved of funds and feeling a lack of sort of forward momentum from government policy, there's a real level of disappointment about that. Many people are seeing it as sort of a downgrading and really a reflection of a failure to understand the economic importance of arts and the significant cultural importance of arts, the sort of gap in terms of arts policy in the country, and this real sort of populist focus as though the electorate is only human beings who are interested in sort of, you know, sport and rugby on the weekend and, you know, and that's the entirety of sort of Australian culture. So I think sometimes you can read too much into these things. Sometimes there are arguments for these sorts of restructures. But I think that those who are concerned about the significance of this one actually have reason to be concerned.
See, Misha, a lot of people think that this restructure means that it just disappears. The arts program policy development funding disappears. As long as that's retained somewhere in the department, does it really matter whether the word arts appears in the title of the organisation?
That's a good question, and it really depends on how it functions.
And let me give you another view on that. I mean, the Department of Human Services, for example, covers a whole range of things, and none of those things actually appear in that title. Or the Department of Justice, you know, it deals with police, it deals with corrections, it deals with regulation around a whole range of consumer issues. It doesn't appear in the title of the.
So what about if you didn't have a Ministry of Health, you just put it into something else?
Well, it actually used to be part of the Department of Human Services.
Okay, so let me answer that question another way, which is when a government wants to signal a priority, often what they will do is create a department.
Yes. Correct.
So, for example, if you think science is important, you'll create it, you know, Home Affairs, whatever it is. So if we accept that that's true and that that's meaningful, then when you abolish a department, it says something about your priorities and the focus.
It does.
So, I mean, you're absolutely right. Arts will continue to function within this big mega department. In a practical sense, it may not mean a lot, but it's symbolically important, I think, because it actually is a downgrading, taking that name out. And also at a time when we've really seen very little in terms of forward arts policy. I mean, it's not just that this bureaucratic merger has happened. It's what is the government's vision for arts in Australia? What is the forward set of policy objectives? Where are we going? What are we trying to do? I mean, traditionally there are, you know, white papers or there's discussions about what's going to be happening. It just feels like there is no real plan or forward momentum in arts.
I think you're absolutely right that these things do signal the underlying values and the underlying priorities of governments. And I think the sorts of things that they have focused on says a lot more about them than the things that they haven't focused on. So, for example, putting all this effort into repealing a piece of legislation that at the end of the day is not going to make a huge amount of difference, the Medivac legislation, it really is a reflection on who they are.
Well, that's right. I mean, I would argue that it's... I mean, the Medivac legislation in particular is sort of an ideological sort of... there's a certain level of partisan political positioning in that. And, you know, I guess what you're always looking for in a government of any stripe, whether it be sort of coalition or Labor or anything else, is sort of a sense of governing with a sense of the broad sweep of what you're required to do for the electorate. Now, arts might not be Scott Morrison's personal pet interest, but the fact that that sort of reverberates through... and you get this sort of lack of attention or care is concerning. In a true cabinet government, for example, you might have a really strong arts minister who can argue for that area in a certain way. It just feels like we're getting a sense of priorities that are downgrading, I think, certain things that are valuable to the community.
So just to shift the conversation a bit further again, we did this with Kimberly as well, pulling out your magic crystal and your crystal ball and looking into the future. What do you think will be the hot issues in 2020?
Oh, God, I hate those questions. I always think that predicting the future is just fraught with danger and you're bound to get it wrong. And generally, I mean, it's interesting. One of the things is whenever we're asked to make predictions, we always make predictions based on recent experience. Human beings always do this. And there are a lot of people that study predictions in the future, you know, the people who are futurists, and they always say that in actual fact, what we fail to do with these sort of projections, because they are based on extrapolation, is actually... predict or understand the disruption. So the things that actually will happen are often precisely the things that are unexpected. They're sort of disruptive or not a projection of business as usual. So if I were to predict for you, I would say we'd still have a big conversation about climate change and the government would keep going in the direction it is, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd project out. It's probably not very valuable. Probably the valuable thing is to look for what the disruptive changes are going to be. And that's very hard to do. You've got to spend a lot of time. So that's a long and wordy way of not answering your question. I just do not know.
Oh, well, let me frame the question in a different way for you. What would you like to be the top one or two hot political issues on the agenda next year?
Look, in my fantasy world, the asylum seeker issue would be solved. People would be removed from Manus and Nauru. And we would... I would accept a policy that had some boat turnbacks, some aspects of the policy to create sort of a workable political compromise, but without sort of this level of, inhumanity that we're seeing currently. I think that's really concerning. I would be very keen to see a sensible policy response to climate change and a proper debate there. I think we're a long way off that. I think it's really important, in my view, that the government achieves its surplus or something close to it, so it can then put that away as a political issue and start looking at the need for economic stimulus. The economy is running very slow. People are hurting. There's, rising inequality. But in particular, the economic management is a real issue. Wages have been so stagnant for so long. I'd really like to see some movement on that. And generally speaking, I would love to see an end to the culture wars. This sort of idea of hostility, things like the religious freedom legislation, which to me, whatever they're allegedly substantively about protecting, seem to be about a sort of level of sort of cultural tension or hostility, which I don't think is necessary. So that would be some of the things I'd wish for.
So that's a list of five issues. Summary of those is human rights, climate change, economic management, equality, and culture wars, settling the culture wars.
Yeah, I'd love to see all those things.
That would be my small Christmas. Agenda. That would be my Christmas wish list as well. Actually,
I'd like to add to that. I want to see a return to integrity and transparency in government at local, state, and federal level. And the best way to achieve that is total public funding of election campaigns.
I thought my list was impossibly utopian until you said that.
So let's drill into one of those a little bit. What? And I know I'm asking you to predict now, which you don't like doing, but the culture wars debate, which is one that's very dear to our community. Interestingly enough, from my personal perspective, a number of organisations that I work with have actually identified this as being a problem for them.
Mm.
And are starting to do some policy thinking around what would happen if this was the scenario. So that is really disturbing that you've got NGOs and government agencies who are beginning to actually think about the implications of this for them already. Where do you think this might land next year? Because, the Prime Minister was keen to resolve it this year, and of course he hasn't.
I think at worst we'll probably get some lukewarm, mildly concerning legislation that gets through the House next year. It also might get derailed by other things, which wouldn't be a bad outcome. Mm. I just can't see this as a significant pressing issue in terms of the Religious Freedom Bill in particular that needs addressing. I think more generally we are, if you think back to the... the same-sex marriage plebiscite, and you think about the resounding response from the Australian population at a time when there was so many very sort of...
Strident
and misleading and nasty messages perpetuated. That's such a great cause for hope, because there are actually people who aren't interested in that sort of divisive... way of thinking about things. It's almost as though the political process is trying to imagine conflict into being. What happens if you're a cake maker in a blah, 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 and this happens and that happens and that happens? It's such a stretch of imagination even to find these conflicts. They aren't really there. Yeah. The community aren't experiencing them. Where these sorts of ideas of rights or values do come into conflict, they're generally so easily resolved with a bit of sensible goodwill. Yet somehow the political system is fixating on these things, blowing them up, trying to turn people against each other. It's sort of almost a hyper hyperactive sense of conflict and the value of conflict in the system itself. It's like the system feeding on conflict that I think is really terribly destructive, and I would love to see an end to it.
Why do you think the government's invested in this? Is it a distraction from the real issues, perhaps?
I think that the reality is, and we may have discussed this previously, is that within the coalition, there was a section that was felt somewhat disenfranchised by the same-sex marriage outcome, and there was a need to, within the coalition itself, try to deal with that group. But I think it's a political mistake. I think it's unnecessary.
Mm. And I think there's an element here that a lot of the advocates, the free speech absolutionists in the government, and you know, a number of them in the Senate, that they say, well, you know, people should be allowed to say what they want and whatever, and okay, let's take that on face value. For those people, when people say things that they find, that they don't agree with and they find offensive, they actually don't care. Mm. Because even if it's applied to them, or if those remarks are about them, they don't care. They ignore them. And they have a position of power and influence and the ability to respond in other ways that most people don't. They don't see these issues through the eyes of the people that these comments do hurt and that do care about them, and that it does influence their life. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that when parliamentarians, and particularly on this issue, they take up an issue that, okay, is deeply personal, I understand that and I respect that, but they actually don't see it through the eyes of the people that it's really going to impact on. So they're immune to this. They're immune to free speech where it's dangerous and where it's divisive, because they just dismiss it. They just go, yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting how, you know, personal values or beliefs really define which issues are picked up, and the levels perhaps sometimes of inconsistency. It was interesting this week, we saw that, you know, Tony Abbott went to visit George Pell, and at the same time there's been a lot of discussion about perhaps the level of activity within the government in terms of protecting Julian Assange, who's facing extradition. So it's interesting which issues...
Do you think he used his parliamentary entitlements as ex-PM or ex-MP to fly down to visit George Pell?
I do not know. I think it's an interesting question.
How taxes at work to go and visit a kiddie fiddler?
Well, if he used his entitlements, we don't know the answer to that. But, I mean, I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
Mr. We're out of time, unfortunately. It's been really good chatting with you again.
The whole year.
Thank you. It's been a fun year.
So, on a personal level, are you going to take a break or have some time off? Or
I am. I'm actually limping to the end now. I don't know about you guys. But it's that point in the year where it's just like, I just want to get it.
Yeah, I've got 2 weeks and I just can't wait. Yeah. 2 weeks and I'm going to have a holiday, actually. I'm going to take
another holiday?
Yeah.
Well, just, you know, just
switch
off.
3 months ago.
I'm just going to... No, well, that's from Joy Macca.
Just that period of time of, like, only wearing shoes when the cement is too hot. That's what I want. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Misha Ketchum, great to have you in the studio. Have a great break. Best for the season and best for the new year.
Thank you, and the listeners.
Thank you very much.
The listener says, watch the last Q&A for the year. Malcolm Turnbull's on there. Yeah, that'll be interesting.
That should make interesting TV. Absolutely. That was Misha Ketchum, the editor of The Conversation, which is a fabulous online news bulletin, I suppose.
Source.
Evidence-based, evidence-informed, fabulous
writing. Some
nice pieces
of work on there, Tass.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.